From the heartland of America and the gateway to the West, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation around the world. I'm George Norrie, and welcome to this most remarkable program called Coast to Coast AM. Next hour, investigative mythologist William Henry joins us with some of his thoughts and theories. An official investigation into the accident at the Large Hadron Collider, CERN, has recommended that an early warning system now be installed. This system would apparently detect the early stages of a helium leak. Now, following an incident that has shut down the LHC until June of 2009, the collider is being built to smash protons together at huge speeds, recreating conditions moments after the Big Bang. Scientists hope it will shed light on fundamental questions in physics. Lots of earthquakes over the weekend. A 5.6 magnitude earthquake hit an island off Iran's southern coast on Sunday, injuring five people, damaging buildings, according to Iranian media. The U.S. Geological Agency reporting a powerful earthquake has struck off of East Timor's coast, but there have been no reports of injuries or damage there. And on Friday night when we were on the air, a magnitude 5.1 earthquake rumbled across Southern California Friday night. The moderate quake near San Bernardino County, just east of Barstow, could be felt from Los Angeles to San Diego. No damage reported there. Pakistani militants attacked a parked convoy of trucks carrying military vehicles for Western forces in Afghanistan near Peshawar early on Sunday, destroying 96 trucks. Security guards said they were overpowered by more than 200 militants who attacked two terminals on the Ring Road around the northwestern city of Peshawar, where the trucks carrying Humvees and other military vehicles were parked. The Pakistani High Commissioner says India was ready to launch a military strike on Pakistan in retaliation for the Mumbai terror attacks. British and American officials apparently had to intervene to prevent India from carrying out an attack. With an eye on the immediate aftermath of the 1941 attack on Pearl Harbor, thousands of World War II veterans and other observers commemorating the 67th anniversary of the devastating Japanese military raid. The theme of the event, Pacific War Memories, the heroic response to Pearl Harbor, is something of a departure from the past. Usually, the commemoration focuses on the attack on the USS Arizona, Pearl Harbor, and other installations in Oahu, but this year's remembrance ceremony will center more on the months following the raid. This is tradition here at Coast to Coast to remember December 7th, 1941, and this memorable speech by then-President Franklin Delano Roosevelt.
Yesterday, December 7th, 1941, a date which will live in infamy, the United States of America was suddenly and deliberately attacked by naval and air forces of the Empire of Japan. The United States was at peace with that nation, and at the solicitation of Japan, was still in conversation with its government and its emperor, looking toward the maintenance of peace in the Pacific. Indeed, 1 hour after, Japanese air squadrons had commenced bombing in the American island of Oahu, the Japanese ambassador to the United States and his colleague delivered to our Secretary of State a formal reply to a recent American message. And while this reply stated that it seemed useless to continue the existing diplomatic negotiations, it contained no threat or hint of war or of armed attack. It will be recorded that the distance of Hawaii from Japan makes it obvious that the attack was deliberately planned many days or even weeks ago. During the intervening time, the Japanese government has deliberately sought to deceive the United States by false statements and expressions of hope for continued peace. The attack yesterday on the Hawaiian Islands has caused severe damage to American naval and military forces. I regret to tell you that very many American lives have been lost. In addition, American ships have been reported torpedoed on the high seas between San Francisco and Honolulu. Yesterday, the Japanese government also launched an attack against Malaya. Last night, Japanese forces attacked Hong Kong. Last night, Japanese forces attacked Guam. Last night, Japanese forces attacked the Philippine Islands. Last night, the Japanese attacked Wake Island. And this morning, the Japanese attacked Midway Island. Japan has therefore undertaken a surprise offensive extending throughout the Pacific area. The facts of yesterday and today speak for themselves. The people of the United States have already formed their opinions and well understand the implications to the very life and safety of our nation. As Commander-in-Chief of the Army and Navy, I have directed that all measures be taken for our defense. But always will our whole nation remember the character of the onslaught against us. No matter how long it may take us to overcome this premeditated invasion, the American people in their righteous might will win through to absolute victory. I believe that I interpret the will of the Congress and of the people when I assert that we will not only defend ourselves to the uttermost, but will make it very certain that this form of treachery shall never again endanger us. Hostilities exist. There is no blinking at the fact that our people, our territory, and our interests are in grave danger. With confidence in our armed forces, with the unbounding determination of our people, we will gain the inevitable triumph. So help us God.
Hard to believe, 67 years ago. In a moment, historian Douglas Dietrich joins us as we talk about Pearl Harbor. The Supreme Court held off Friday on deciding whether to grant a hearing in a long-shot lawsuit that would decide whether Barack Obama can constitutionally become president as a natural-born U.S. citizen. The Friday list of court orders that denies or grants hearings did not mention the lawsuit, which says that Mr. Obama should be disqualified from the presidency because he purportedly acquired the same British citizenship that his father had when he was born. This suit does not deny that he was born in Hawaii. It merely says that he is a British citizen. Spokesperson for the court said the decision on whether to hear the suit, brought by a New Jersey lawyer, is likely to be announced sometime this coming week. In Beaumont, Texas, a trailer carrying children in a Christmas parade struck and killed a 10-year-old girl who had jumped out of a pickup truck driving along the floats. The girl had been jumping on and off during the parade route and was told to stop doing it before falling and hitting her head. She was then struck by a trailer behind her. In a moment, Douglas Dietrich joins us as we talk about the historical process of Pearl Harbor next on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast. I'm George Norrie. Douglas Dietrich is the son of a retired U.S. Navy sailor. Douglas worked for 10 years as a Department of Defense research librarian at the Presidio military base of San Francisco, where one of his major duties was document destruction. He then experienced the 1991 Kuwaiti campaign, serving Desert Storm as a United States Marine. Douglas has studied and connected historical process which led to the actions on December 7th, 1941, Pearl Harbor. He's with us this hour. We'll take calls later. Douglas, thanks for serving, by the way. Good to have you with us.
Yeah, thanks so much, George. I really appreciate this opportunity. I also want to thank Daniel Brinkley, who was kind enough to call me after the passing of my father. And with my father's death, I finally found enough time to dedicate towards writing a book, which is still in the process of being written.
Excellent. Now, let's talk a little bit now about what led up to the attack of Pearl Harbor, and also get your take a little bit later on what you think we knew prior to the attack.
Sure. Well, within 6 weeks after inauguration, FDR abolished the gold standard in 1933. He had to, in order to flood the U.S. economy with enough liquidity to print enough paper money for the economy to expand. By doing this, he made the U.S. dollar the de facto global currency, as it wasn't tied down to any reserves. And in July 1939, FDR named a Canadian citizen who had never applied, nor during his lifetime would ever be awarded, U.S. citizenship as the White House economist to advise on taxation, Social Security, U.S. Treasury affairs, and most tellingly, the speeding up of wartime production. This man was Lachlan Curie, who emerged from the freshman brain trust of the U.S. Treasury. He was known as Mr. Inside by the American press, and he testified before the temporary National Economic Committee to highlight the role of big government budgets in the recovery process. Now, Lachlan Curie outlined what he insisted to be the ideal monetary system for the United States, which included 100% reserved banking plans to strengthen central banking by preventing member banks from lending out their demand deposit liabilities while removing reserve requirements on savings deposits with low turnover.
Sounds familiar, doesn't it?
It's a repeat of what may be happening today, but hopefully what's happening today is less orchestrated. As administrative assistant to the president, Curie drafted the Banking Act of 1935, reorganizing the Federal Reserve and strengthening its powers. He also constructed a net federal income-creating expenditure series to show the strategic role of fiscal policy and complementary monetary policies to revive an economy in acute, persistent depression. And if all of this sounds suspiciously collectivist, it should, because Lachlan Curie was an identified Soviet operative. VENONA, V-E-N-O-N-A, all caps, was an ongoing project that decrypted Soviet cables preceding the war and lasting throughout the war itself. These intercepted cables identified Curie as a source of Soviet intelligence. VENONA, it's been a long time since I've used these terms, but it exposed Curie as operating under the cover name of Page. And Soviet intelligence archives themselves classified his codename as VIM, V-I-M. He was known by the FBI to be a member of both the Golos and Bentley spy networks. And contemporary VENONA intercepts and the KGB notes of NKVD official Gayek Ovakimian, Ovakimian, I believe he was of Armenian descent, categorized Lachlan Curie as the head of the Silver Master Ring of Soviet agents who served as Washington, D.C. economists. The name of the Silver Master Ring itself was a play on manipulating America off of the gold standard. Now, when Lachlan Curie was incontrovertibly cover-blown by the admitted Soviet agent Elizabeth Bentley in August of 1948, he appealed to the United Nations for international asylum. And in 1949, he was appointed to head the first of the World Bank's comprehensive country surveys to Colombia, where he ultimately stayed as a Colombian citizen to integrate Colombia's economy into the World Bank's banking system until the day he died. But in January 1941, having been informed by the FBI of Curie's operational status as a resident foreign agent, FDR sent him on a mission to China for operational coordination with the Chinese Communist Party. There, Curie met with Zhou Enlai, the Chinese foreign minister of Mao's Communist Party, and finally returned in March. Then FDR put him in charge of the pre-war Chinese Lend-Lease program to oversee Chennault's Flying Tigers. And in May 1941, Curie presented FDR with document JB355, and JB355 was serialized as 591 in document status. JB stood for Joint Board, which is equivalent to today's Joint Chiefs of Staff.
Okay.
That meant that this plan was reviewed and recommended by Hap Arnold, the Secretary of the Navy, as well as the Secretary of War. This document was titled Aircraft Requirements for the Chinese Government, and explicitly planned the bombing of Japan by Chenault's Flying Tigers, flying under false Chinese insignia, but using Lockheed Hudson's flying out of Chuzhou, Nanjiao, and Hangzhou, excuse me, Hangzhou is the modern name for it, to attack Nagasaki, Osaka Kobe, and Tokyo, respectively.
And without any reason, Douglas, they were just going to attack.
They were going to attack because they felt Japan to be a tremendous threat financially, because what had happened was Adolf Hitler wanted to get rid of his Jewish population, and Japan was the only nation accepting Jewish immigrants. They provided 50,000 of them with their own nation state in Manchuria, known as Birodijan. It was conquered by the Soviets at the end of the Second World War and still exists today on the maps if you look up the Jewish Autonomous Oblast, but most of the Jewish population has migrated to Israel. The national language was Yiddish, but Secretary Morgenthau told FDR that this would give Japan all kinds of connections into international finance, into international media, stuff that it never had before, because as a colored nation, it just didn't have the wherewithal to interact with many of the colonial powers in the pre-war world. This is hard for us to understand today, but the world of that day was autarkic, colonial.
All right, well, capsulize this for me then, Douglas, because I want to get into some of the nitty-gritty of Pearl Harbor.
Sure.
Capsulize, basically, there was a plan then to attack Japan. What did they do? The Japanese found out about it and decided to attack first, or what?
That is correct, yes. On July 22nd, 1941, Lachlan Curie cabled General Chenault to prepare his illegal mercenary wing, illegal by the laws of the League of Nations, for this same secret bomber offensive with 66 bombers to be delivered in theater. And the first 24 Lockheed Hudson bombers arrived in China on July 25th, 5 months before Pearl Harbor, while the U.S. Army Air Corps was relocating the entire 19th Bombardment Group based out of Hickam Field, Hawaii, to the Philippines. And what happened concurrently with this was that on July 26, 1941, FDR froze all of Japan and China's assets in the United States. And this was far more than just a trade embargo. It eviscerated Japan's laboriously accumulated international monetary reserves. By 1941, war all over the globe had congealed the financial systems of all the world powers into autarky blocks, rendering their currencies inconvertible. And abroad, the yen itself was illiquid, that is, not acceptable for payments outside of the Japanese empire. The United States stood in the extraordinary position of controlling nearly all of the world's negotiable monetary resources, and it abused this extraordinary power to bankrupt Japan and devastate any ability to mobilize its national economy to respond to the planned bombing offensive.
Isn't it amazing, Douglas, how the financial end of this seems to crop up in every issue?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And the freeze of Chinese assets blocked Japanese assets to the world through Shanghai, through the Shanghai markets and the Shanghai exchange. Just to clarify what happened, there was a spy in Japan who was a Soviet agent by the name of Richard Sorge. He was Azerbaijani. Azerbaijan is the same nation which has given us Garry Kasparov. His statue still stands in Azerbaijan today as a martyr to the Soviet cause. The Japanese arrested him on October 18th, and Lachlan Curie had been feeding him knowledge of the upcoming plans for bombardment. The Japanese tortured him until he broke, and they executed him in Tokyo in public on November 7th.
November 7th. Okay, so then they attacked a month later.
That's correct. And while they were doing that, the Americans were still shipping enormous shipments of bombers to various areas, both in mainland China and the Philippines, preparing for their December 8th strike. And that was the date that the Japanese got out of Richard Sorge. And it's important to remember that this was simultaneous to Japan suffering under the financial freeze of the United States.
Did we know, Douglas, then, even though this was all being done, did we know that the Japanese, that they were going to attack?
The Japanese were not going to attack the United States at all. The reason that they were forced to was for the reasons that I gave.
No, I know, but did we know they were coming once all this came out?
Oh, excellent question. Yes, at that point, It was all too obvious to the United States because they had, and this is what every conventional historian, even at the academic levels in the United States, will admit, they broke the Japanese codes through the ultra-slash-magic programs years before. They had been interpreting Japanese codes and deciphering them for years.
More to come, Douglas, when we come right back. Plus, we'll open up phone lines as we talk about Pearl Harbor. This is Douglas's investigation, and he has been connected with the historical process for a long, long time. We'll be back. We'll be back in a moment. We'll take more of your phone calls with Douglas Dietrich when we come back. Also, at the top of next hour, William Henry joins us, investigative mythologist on Coast to Coast AM. And we're going to take your calls this half hour with Douglas Dietrich here as we talk about Pearl Harbor. Douglas, curious, why were you in charge of document destruction when you were over there with the Defense Research Department?
Well, quite simply, it was the job that they gave to the man at the bottom of the ladder. It was dirty work, and it involved work with the incinerator. And a lot of the older librarians were just so lazy and so corrupt and incompetent, they literally didn't want to do anything they didn't have to do. And that's how I ultimately was put in charge of records that I was never supposed to see. I need to emphasize the fact that I never had a very high security clearance. My security clearance was pretty much rock bottom, basically what every dependent on a military base needs to enter and exit a military base. But those people who had the higher levels of security clearance and were put in charge of enormous amount of documents had wound up leaving just literally boxes and boxes of these documents lying around since the 1970s. As a matter of fact, that was when JB 355 was declassified, and they hadn't gotten around to destroying them.
it's currently now. And are you saying that the Federal Reserve, the same Federal Reserve that is helping to create this economic mess we're in today, that they were part of this Japanese-American war situation, that they helped push it?
Absolutely. Japan had ample liquid assets, dollars in U.S. banks and gold bars in Tokyo vaults, that it was using to pay relatively small international debts incurred by the China War and by fighting an illegal war that the Americans were conducting via Chenault's Flying Tigers. But Japan was not insolvent, but on July 26, 1941, FDR's penstroke rendered the entire nation of Japan illiquid. The freeze isolated Japan economically from the outside world, voiding its monetary assets, both sums on hand or obtainable in the future, and could send to buy strategic goods within the U.S.-dominated Western Hemisphere or in any country that exported for dollars was withheld by the United States in conjunction with parallel freezes simultaneously initiated at Roosevelt's insistence by the British and Dutch empires that controlled enormous areas of the Pacific Asian world surrounding Japan. The pre-war colonial powers called this the ABCD stranglehold, standing for the American, British, Chinese, and Dutch East Indies economic strangulation, intended to bring Japan to its knees while bombardment began.
So you're saying, Douglas, that the tremendous sailors that died, thousands of them that died in Pearl Harbor, and then the so many who died fighting the Japanese, soldiers of all ranks, all of that was unnecessary.
That's correct. We need to start looking at World War II in the same way that we look at Vietnam and Iraq, in the sense of respect the warrior but hate the war, support the troops but hate the men who send them to die. And until we learn to get rid of the good war myth of World War II, which leaves America with this kind of cultural autism, almost all of our analogies historically are World War II analogies. Until we learn to see World War II as a series of regional wars, as we saw Vietnam, Korea, and Iraq, because that is essentially what they were, then we will never understand World War II, because the only thing that made it a global war was in 1941 when FDR declared war against Japan. Simultaneously, Germany, Italy, Romania, Croatia, Hungary, Bulgaria, they all declared war on the United States, as well as the empires of Asia, the empire of Manchuria, the empire of Vietnam under Bao Dai, who had been put back into power by the Japanese, Thailand's emperor, they all simultaneously declared war on the United States. But it would have remained a Pacific Asian war if Roosevelt had not made it global by using this monetary bludgeon.
Unbelievable. Let's take some calls here. Let's go to Hannah, Wyoming. Peter, west of the Rockies, you're on with us. Hi, Peter.
How you doing tonight, George?
Great, thanks.
And Douglas, how are you?
Good to talk to you, Peter.
Yeah, I'd like to say, Douglas, I didn't know where you'd go with this, but I've got to say you've got an extremely good grasp on it.
Thank you, sir.
I'm a veteran cryptologist and happened to be in the outfit that broke the code,
wow.
Ebony's code.
Thanks for serving.
Yeah, thank you. And we did definitely break the code and had the entire Japanese Navy codes by January 1941.
Incredible.
And turned them over to the British and all the Allies.
Well, you must have noticed, sir, that on the day of Pearl Harbor itself, every single modern weapon, all of the aircraft carriers and all of the submarines were not in Pearl. They weren't in Oahu. They were all at sea on evasive combat maneuvers. And the only things left at Pearl Harbor were World War I Dreadhulks that it was unanimously agreed would never make it through another war.
Exactly.
And not to mention, all of the men at sea were World War I veteran sailors like my father, men who knew how to fight a war. They sent them to sea so they wouldn't die. But all the men left at Pearl Harbor were young swabbies who were about 17 to 18 years old. You were there. You must have noticed how young all these guys were with no combat experience.
Yeah, of course, I'm not that old, but I'm fairly old.
Oh, well, I'm sure you must have been one of the 16-year-olds running around.
No, I'm a Cold War vet, but know the history. That's one of our proud moments that we broke all the Japanese codes in the Naval Security Group.
Right.
And, of course, George, I don't know what you did in the Navy exactly, but...
9 years public information, never public saw information. Combat, nothing.
You knew about the Naval Security, though, right?
Oh, sure, absolutely.
Naval Security Group. Yeah, now that... we had all the Japanese Navy, especially the naval codes.
Right.
There were some that we couldn't break, but we had all the naval codes by January of 1941.
Right. Well, you would be one of the people who, studying the history of the cryptography department of the U.S. Navy, you would know that the destroyer, the USS Ward, fired on Japanese ships over an hour and a half before the attack on Pearl Harbor. It was on those evasive combat maneuvers at sea escorting the USS Enterprise, and they were given medals for firing the first shot of the war. And the U.S. carrier Enterprise actually sent out 18 Douglas SBD Dauntless dive bombers to attack the Japanese from their carrier deck on the day of Pearl Harbor because they were out on combat maneuvers and Halsey saw what was going on. All of this implies pre-knowledge that I'm sure you can confirm.
The Pacific conflict that was occurring, Douglas, are you saying that we should have just simply bowed out, backed off, not gotten involved?
Yes, and I'm afraid it's worse than you might imagine, because when FDR was saying America had not been in combat with Japan, obviously people think of Chenault's Flying Tigers, but people forget that the United States Marine Corps had Carlson's raiders in mainland China. And what people tend to forget is that General Carlson himself was an adamant communist. He had fully converted to the communist cause and actually wrote about reading Red Star Over China, written by Edgar Snow, finding that the communist Chinese way of war was the way the Marines should be fighting war, with no officers and no enlisted men, but rather fighters and leaders. And he had actually attacked the Japanese while they were holding a peace summit in Nanjing, and that's what led to the Nanjing massacre.
Okay, next up, let's go to Floyd in San Antonio, Texas, east of the Rockies. You're on with Douglas Dietrich. Hi, Floyd.
Yes, gentlemen. I'm a very serious Pearl Harbor student, amateur student all my life, and I have a very quick, serious question to ask Doug. But first, I want to ask you, George, when you get William Henry, ask him to give you an updated story or expansion on the one-footed snorkel monster, okay?
Okay.
All right, now for Pearl Harbor. For years, I've read this transcript between Winston Churchill and FDR on the phone that was intercepted by the Germans, where they discussed the details of the Pearl Harbor attack about 2 weeks before it occurred. And I wonder if Doug had ever read or seen that before and get his opinion on it.
I apologize, sir. That's something that I didn't run into while I was dealing with the particular files I was dealing with. That's almost at a diplomatic level of specific leaders. I have no doubt that the Germans had probably intercepted it, as you say, but it's one of those things that is part of a very large puzzle of which I was given probably the pivotal pieces of in terms of threads to add to the fabric, but that one is out of my range, I'm afraid.
Well, at least I know one thing that a lot of people don't know. It's there on the Internet. You can read it.
Mm-hmm.
But thanks for talking to me, guys.
Thank you.
Okay, my friend. Thank you. Doug, I do have to compliment you on your homework on this. A perspective that doesn't surprise me in terms of the Federal Reserve's involvement in the monetary situation. Seems like that seems to be the death knell for everything that goes on this planet.
Yes, it certainly does. And I would like to emphasize, George, then that when I speak of the irregular operations going on in China, I do not mean in any way, shape, or form to justify Japanese atrocities conducted in pre-war China.
No, obviously. I understand that.
Yeah.
I understand that. Let's go next to Gainesville, Florida. Ray, you're on the air with us. Hi, Ray.
Hey, George and Douglas. Listen, this may be drifting a little off the subject, but my brother was born on December 7th, 1941. And I lost contact with him and my sister, and I solely would like to get a hold back with my brother. I've tried several times to, at least celebrate on his birthday.
How'd you guys get separated? What happened?
Well, it's kind of my fault. I moved away and just didn't contact him.
You did. Yeah.
Her inheritance was the last time I saw my brother.
Oh,
and
okay.
It's kind of
all
my
right.
fault.
Well, you know what? I would recommend for you, Ray, too, is get a PI, a private investigator. You would be surprised that with the era of what they can get with an Internet search, what they could find. I mean, truly incredible. Let's go to Japan. Susan, you are with us way out there. Hi, Susan.
Good afternoon. Excuse me, I'm really nervous. One of the things that I've noticed here, and I talked to a gentleman about it yesterday, a Japanese citizen, we as Americans seem to focus on the past. We have all the D-Day programs. We have programs like this, that we keep rehashing the past. And I asked this gentleman yesterday, why aren't I seeing it on Japanese TV? And he goes, we want to focus on the future and rebuilding our future. And it was just a very interesting perspective for me.
I really appreciate your saying that, Susan. At the same time, it also is a tragedy of national cultural consciousness being fragmented, because the Americans, and this is what makes me so angry when Americans complain about Japanese textbooks on the war being whitewashed, not mentioning the atrocities. Well, the Americans made it illegal during the period of martial law and occupation for the Japanese to say anything about the war in any of their educational facilities. So by law, they can't say anything, and the Japanese generations have grown up with a total vacuum of the war. It's not that they find the war was justified in any way. They absolutely know nothing about it. There are very few museums or antiques concerning Japanese militaria, but we do have to acknowledge the fact that because Japan was looked on as one of the front lines of defense for the West in the Pacific, they of necessity have had to build a maritime self-defense force, which is a Coast Guard technically, which is larger than most other people's navies, and just recently launched an aircraft carrier, the first of four. But it's classified, because it's illegal for them to build aircraft carriers, which would be offensive, they classify it as a super destroyer. This is the kind of madness that we're left.
The only place I was told that I could find military history would be where they dropped the atom bombs.
Yes.
And I was told there was no place in Tokyo where I could go find any military history.
There's a few scattered military museums in Japan, but they're extremely isolated, and they're almost spoken of in whispers. The National Shrine of the Samurai Warriors and the Kamikaze Warriors who sacrificed themselves in combat still stands. It's part of the Shinto religion. But in terms of Japan's dealing with the future, they have to come to grips with the past, and America needs to understand the struggle with Japan in the same light that it sees the struggle with Vietnam and Korea as basically an Asian war that would have been regionalized if it hadn't been for the factors that I brought up. But I really want to thank you for bringing that up, the fact that it emphasizes that cultural fragmentation. And I hope that we can create a healing in Japan's connection with its past so that it can have a better future. And I hope that America can look at today's world without constantly going back to World War II, which they misperceive as the highlight of their existence.
Yeah. Douglas, why'd you wait until now to bring all this out?
Well, my father had recently died in 2007, and I didn't have the care provision requirements that I had to face up to before. And certainly I had shared all of this with my father many years before his death. So he was well aware of this historical perspective long before he passed on. And because of that, I feel that my father really was able to grow as a person. And I think that a lot of American GIs who were veterans of the Second World War didn't have that opportunity to really intellectually grasp a lot of what propelled them into this titanic struggle, because if they had been given this knowledge, which not necessarily was hidden by conspiracy, but was just prevented from any access to academia or any general public, if they had had knowledge of this, maybe they would have had a much more solid grounds on which to judge their leaders who have led us into every war since that time.
All right, next up we go to Jonathan west of the Rockies in Montana. Hey, Jonathan, go ahead.
Hey, I wanted to thank your guest. I thought that his perspective is very unique, but I wanted to know what he thought of the Standard Oil tanker incident in the Yangtze River in the 1930s and other Chinese aggression towards Western influence before the monetary impacts that he was sanctions that he was talking about.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you for bringing that up.
Okay.
Basically, it was, as I said, the problem is I'll have to make a kind of detour here or else it's not going to make any sense. One of the reasons that America was in Indochina for such a long period of time, and they were in Indochina before World War II as well, was they had inherited what the British Empire had started. And what the British Empire was dealing in that made it the richest empire on earth for the longest period of time was opium. And if it's bad enough to imagine a drug dealer standing on your street corner outside your window and dealing drugs, but the British were the equivalent of a drug dealer who brought artillery and blew your house down until you allowed them to use your house as the drug dealing den. That's what they had done in China. And the Japanese had inherited this opium-infested economy, this opium-saturated economy, because the opium wars had made it legally a necessity that Chinese smoke opium. And all of this cannonball-sized balls of opium were being shipped out of India to China. Well, America picked that trade up. And we know about this from Vietnam because of Air America with the CIA shipping tons of opium out of Indochina. But before World War II, there was no CIA. It was called the China National Aviation Corporation. And this was organized in 1929 when Curtis Wright Corporation and Chiang Kai-shek agreed to fund the country's first airline. And several years later, Kurt Wright sold its interest in CNAC to Pan Am, which used it as a feed liner for the China Clipper service. These were WDC-2s and DC-3 transports. Now, they were shipping tons of opium into Manchuria, and the Japanese were attempting to stop them by shooting them down. That's why Chenault Flying Tigers got there in the first place. They were escorts for these planes.
Chicago, Illinois. Elizabeth, we got about a minute left. Go ahead, Elizabeth.
Okay, I want to thank the gentleman very much for coming out with his information. I'm a bride of a Vietnam veteran. We were exposed to Agent Orange, and many of the guys now from the Persian Gulf are being exposed to mental and physical situations. And I really feel that it's to lack the production of other human beings to come onto the earth, because it seems awfully funny that these guys are being exposed to all this stuff. And many immigrants are coming into the country who neither like us nor do they care one way or the other about America. And they don't even follow the laws of having physicals or are sneaking different things in, and we're getting the bottom of the pot from many of the different countries, it seems.
Go ahead. We're almost out of time.
Yeah, I want to respond to that by saying my father always wanted to recall all of the troops from the outside world and put them on the border. And certainly what the young lady is referring to is something that we are experiencing now in Iraq. Just like in Vietnam, every international cancer symposium is opened by a Vietnamese doctor because everyone has liver disease in Vietnam to one degree or another due to Agent Orange. Well, in Iraq, because of depleted uranium, they have the equivalent of 44,000 Hiroshima-sized atomic bombs in terms of radiation floating around.
I mean, Joyce Riley was telling us about that. Douglas, thanks. We're up next. William Henry joins us, investigative mythologist on Coast to Coast AM.